Question number one from Kirby is Judas saved? Matthew chapter 27. He's called a son of perdition, but it is also true that in Matthew chapter 27, he does some things that may possibly look like repentance that would give us hope. He says in particular in verse 4, I have sinned, for I have betrayed innocent blood. Who cares, they say. That's your problem. Slight paraphrase. And he threw the money into the temple, left, went away, and hanged himself. I think the hanging of oneself is our clue that he is not repentant in a godly way. I think whether deliberate or not, whether this is on Paul's mind or not, it's possible that he was thinking of Judas, I suppose, but it certainly seems to fit in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 9, well, really verses 8 to 10. He's talking about the sorrow caused in the Corinthian church by his letter. He says he's sorry that he hurt them, but now he's happy because you were made sorry, not because you were made sorry, but because your sorrow led you to repentance. You became sorrowful as God intended. Now we're getting close. As God intended, and so were not harmed in any way by us. In other words, I caused you grief that helped you. Godly sorrow leads to repentance. Sorry, brings repentance that leads to salvation and leaves no regret. But worldly sorrow brings death. There's no reason to believe if he had really been healed in his statement, I have sinned, if he was truly penitent, why would he have killed himself? Which is, of course, a sign of a curse and a great sin. I'm not saying that somebody who commits suicide can't be saved. I'm saying you put it together with the rest of what he did, his repudiation of Christ, selling the Christ, entered by Satan, John says, son of perdition. The message about him in Acts chapter 1, that this is fulfilling the prophecy in Psalm 69, that Jesus will be betrayed by one of his own, who shared intimacy with him. You put it together, and it's pretty clear that Judas was not sincerely penitent, but merely grieving over his sin, the consequences of his sin, and so forth. Second question is asked by Cliff. Cliff, you want to ask your question again? Okay. The question is, I said that the Jewish leaders wanted to stay just within the tortured bounds of superficial or technical legality. They wanted to bend the law. Cliff says, wait a minute. It says they called forth false witnesses. They're calling forth false witnesses. They've got to know that that's not valid. Number one, false witnesses. Matthew tells us they're false witnesses. They might not have known that they were false witnesses. Matthew's writing for us, not simply giving a stenographic report. But the other thing, and I think more important, and we agreed on this in our little discussion, is that if they were really just willing to violate any law, why would they have called up one after another? See, they would have just called up two and said, okay, that's enough. But they kept calling them up. And they also admitted that it wasn't working when they asked the question themselves. So they wanted to preserve for themselves what? A fig leaf. You know, some veneer of legality. And again, we don't really know what was happening in detail, but there are little signs throughout the Gospels that not all the Jewish leaders are one and the same, right? We have, you know, Joseph of Arimathea, and we have Nicodemus. You know, there might have been 10 or 15 that were not quite so sure they were doing the right thing, and you know, they had to preserve their reputation. Again, that's conjectural. But the hard evidence is that they gave up the path of false witnesses. By that I mean biblical evidence, and then moved a different way. I also need to just point out again, there's a typo in your notes that or mistake that I just didn't correct. It is one-third of a year, not 2 years' wages. I was saying the right thing when I said one-third of a year. Well, let's look at the crucifixion of Jesus. And again, our goal here is not to look at the pain and the sorrow and to wallow in that, but to hear the narrative again, to hear it really, to hear it as the first readers heard it, to see what the Gospels intend. The Gospels don't dwell at all on the physical sorrows of Christ. They do dwell on his sorrows, but not that kind. What do they dwell on? They dwell instead on the words on the cross. We'll get to those in a minute. I do have to say, again, one of the chief tasks in biblical interpretation, if you're learning yourself or you're teaching others, is to find out how people hear the Bible today and then to figure out where that's wrong and where that needs to be corrected by more accurate knowledge of Jesus' day. One of those points is on the cross, and the difficulty is that it's so familiar and trivialized even. We have, "It's my cross to bear," which can be used of very trivial events. You know, my husband snores terribly. Well, you know, maybe, you know, snoring can be pretty bad, but it's not the same. And crosses are ways of simply identifying a building as a church sometimes. Just, hey, this is a church. You can tell because there's a cross on it. And even, of course, crosses can be, you know, real pretty. They can be jewelry, just as people wear angels around their necks and things like that, other religious things, they wear crosses. And I see people in here with crosses. I don't mean to put that down. That's not my goal. It's never my goal to make anybody, you know, feel that I'm putting them down. But there is an effect of wearing crosses as mere jewelry. I think any Christian who wears a cross is using it to remind themselves of Christ. And maybe even, I would imagine there's some people maybe in this room who used to wear a cross meaninglessly, and now they know what they mean. And they wear it in a different way. And that's fine. But there are other people who wear it as jewelry. And then we lose the meaning of the cross if it's just pretty, if it's just a pretty thing. The cross was a terrible thing. And not pretty at all, wooden crosses, then not polished crosses. What does the cross mean? The cross signifies, again, not simply decoration. It signifies shame. It signifies it is the strongest, most horrible punishment that the Roman could inflict on anyone, never to be inflicted on a Roman citizen, only on slaves and worthless revolutionaries. And then, of course, in the covenant people, in biblical parlance, in the biblical world, of course, the cross signifies the curse of God. Anyone who's hung on a tree is under a curse. Deuteronomy 21:23, and of course, quoted again by Galatians. It also signifies the crowning act of the Jews' rebellion against God. They murdered their Messiah. They killed their Lord, the covenant mediator, the final prophet, the Son of God, the Son of Man, the great high priest, the final sacrifice. They killed him. Pilate said, "I am innocent of this man's blood." He washed his hands and said, "It's your responsibility." And the Jews said, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." A horrible thing to say. Those are some of the things that the cross means. The meaning of the cross, the focus of the Gospels in understanding this, is not at all then on physical events, lashing and the details of Jesus' death, although some are mentioned, such as the sword in his side and the fulfillment of the prophecy that none of his bones would be broken. That's not the main focus. The main focus is words. And again, here we have to think about irony and people telling the truth being right on top of them, and yet somehow they're not seeing it. Again, irony is when the correct interpretation of words or events is the opposite of their apparent meaning. What are some of them? Well, we may have seen one already. "Let his blood be on us and on our children." Well, a terrible self-condemning, self-imprecatory oath. And yet, their only hope that his blood would be on them to cover them. Second, we have the soldiers. If that one's a little bit less than certain that it's intended by the gospel, we certainly know that Caiaphas said it's better for one man to die than the whole nation perish, and he was speaking about Christ's atonement. It is certainly also true that the soldiers who clothed Jesus in a scarlet robe and thrust a crown of sharp thorns on his head and said, "Hail, King of the Jews," were telling most definitely the truth. Jesus reigns from the cross. Their motives may be wicked, but what they say is true. He is the King of the Jews, and they should hail him. When they crucified him, the charge was put over him. The charge was, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." And it's true. He's the King of the Jews. He reigns from the cross. As we'll see in a little more detail next week, even on the cross, he does precisely what a king does. What does a king do? Among other things, he defends his people from their adversaries. Jesus is doing just that. The great adversary is, of course, our own sin, our liability to condemnation. And he is defeating our greatest enemy. He is protecting us from our enemies. He's protecting us from harm. They didn't see it. They didn't know it. But it's true. They didn't see it at all. One person said they were like cows viewing a sunset. You ever seen that? You ever lived in dairy country or driven through it? Beautiful sunset. And there are 100 cows looking right at it. I don't think they're thinking aesthetic thoughts. It was right there, but they couldn't see it. The mockery, among other things, the mockery is foretold. The gambling for Jesus' clothing is foretold. If they would only see that the prophecy is coming true. The mockery is cruel. The mockery also has a certain internal logic. The internal logic is, if Jesus were who he says he is, then he wouldn't be on the cross. The Jewish leaders think they finally got their vindication. Because the custom of the day, sayings from Jesus' own day, was that a righteous man, somebody with a special relationship with God, would never die shamefully. It was actually taught by some of their religious leaders at the time. Some people think that to this day, I guess. A few people do anyway. Of course, the Bible doesn't say that. But they thought, if he's really God, well, what did they say? They said, "He saved others, let him save himself." They said, "He saved others, but he can't save himself." Well, that's true too. If he were really to save others, he can't save himself. He can't, as they taunted him and offered him. He can't come down from the cross, because if he did come down from the cross, he would no longer be saving others. He would no longer be the true and faithful Son of God. And so, irony upon irony. I suppose that was the last temptation of Christ. Avoid the cross, Satan said originally, earlier, way back, we talked about this, bloodless ways of rule. Come down from the cross. Boy, you know, he could have done it. Just for 5 seconds, just to show them, if he'd wanted. He didn't do it. He could have answered them. He could have stricken them dead, but he didn't do it. Instead, when he spoke, he did not speak to condemn, but rather he did say things that interpret his death for us. Probably the most important of them is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Chapter 27, verse 46, sometimes called Jesus' cry of dereliction. "My God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, you've done some reading about this. What is startling about the wording of Jesus' cry. My God, why have you forsaken me? What's singular about the way Jesus talks? It's not personal. What do you mean by that? He usually calls God Father. Can anybody make an even stronger statement than that? John? Always, with one exception, and this is it. What are we to make of that? This, there's about to be a change in the relationship. Here's the question that we need to ask. How should we understand this? And specifically, was he telling the truth? Was he, as some people say, he was just quoting Psalm 22 for our benefit, you know, because it's the first line from Psalm 22. So we would know that we should interpret his death through Psalm 22. Of course, Psalm 22, we could turn to it just for a moment. We're so full of Old Testament allusions, we rarely actually turn to them. But Psalm 22 is laden with statements that predict Jesus' death. Beginning, my God, why have you forsaken me? I cry out, but you don't answer. I am, verse 6, a worm, not a man, scorned by men, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord deliver him. He says, I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. Crucifixion could do that. My heart has turned to wax. Heart failure was one of the consequences of crucifixion. I can count all my bones. The bones were laid bare by crucifixion. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Some people say Jesus wants to call attention to this, so you'll see that the prophecy is being fulfilled. And also to show, because Psalm 22 ends with a cry of triumph and a change of mood to joy, they will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn and so forth, that we should also think of that. I think that's a little bit too coy. We don't, and that depends on how that's said. I'm not saying everybody who quotes Psalm 22 is being coy. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if you make it into a mere quotation of Psalm 22, merely quoting Jesus merely quoting it, in order to show us that the prophecy is being fulfilled and to give hints that it's going to turn out all right, then we remove his words from the realm of genuine words. He really is saying, here's what I'm driving at. Use Psalm 22. But he's really saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's a real statement, not just something for didactic purposes. Some people think that Jesus said it and it was just a mistake. He just felt really bad. He's emoting. And he feels forsaken. But God could never really forsake him. After all, aren't there Bible verses about that? I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. I think we have to say that Jesus is telling the truth and that he is rightly conscious and rightly reporting that he is indeed forsaken by the Father. And to some extent, even, he's groping. Why? How can this be? To some extent, we might say this feeling of abandonment and this groping, I'm not saying he's totally in the dark, but this groping is part of his temptation. He is genuinely abandoned, deserted, and forsaken. We must not tame his words. Why is he forsaken? He's forsaken because he who knew no sin was made to be sin. 2 Corinthians 5:21. He's forsaken because God's eyes are too pure to look upon evil, to behold wrongdoing. Habakkuk 1:13. Because Christ became a curse for us. There is a real separation here. Why? Because this is the great exchange, as it's sometimes called. Jesus bore our sin and gave us his righteousness. Our sin removed, but that's not all. Also his righteousness given, and he really was bearing our sin. He really bore the punishment. And the price was separation from God. This is his descent into hell. The Apostles' Creed says he descended into hell. the essence of hell is separation from God. Here, he is separated from God. That's what he's saying. The mystery of the cross is, of course, how the Trinitarian unity could suffer rupture. There are lots of things you can say here. And maybe your pastor and teachers and you can explore this and say some of those things that may be helpful. But whatever we say, we don't want to explain it away. We don't want to remove the fact in efforts to solve theological problems. The other thing we want to say, another mystery or another statement, I don't know, is the mystery of the cry. How could there be a rupture? There was a rupture. However it happened, I'm not sure. There's also obedience in the cry of Christ. A man named Richard Sibbes, a Puritan theologian, said, "Jesus was never more obedient, never pleased the Father more than when he uttered those words on the cross. It was not one scintilla of sin in that statement." Jesus was telling the truth. Jesus rightly said, my God, why have you forsaken me? So that we would never rightly say, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's what's happening. And there was no sin in it, no straying. He never, Sibbes is right, he never pleased the Father more than when he said that. Because although he felt the distance, he was also finishing the job that was given to him. That's what he was doing. Not balking at the last few steps of the journey, but taking it to the end. And that really leads us to the second statement that he makes, and that is, it is finished. It is finished. How shall we understand those words? I'm not operating in perfect sequence. But the words, it is finished, many of you again have probably heard this explained as, what does it mean, it is finished? One word, tetelestai in the Greek, what does it mean? Somebody said it. Come on, 20 people here know what it means. It is paid in full. And the word, I don't write it down yet though. The word, you can write it down, but there's something else to write down too. The word was used when a bill was paid in full, just as still occasionally you get something stamped that's not used so frequently now at all. But you may still occasionally see a stamp paid when some bill is finally finished and is paid off. If a bill was paid off, they would mark it with that word, it is finished, tetelestai. But there's also another use of that word. And the other use of that word is for discharging a religious obligation. That's used in several places, including John 17:4. It is used to say not only paid in full, but maybe even more prominently, discharged in full. The job is done. It is finished. And of course, in the end, there's no conflict between the it is paid, the job is done motif. And that's why Jesus, again, depends on which gospel you read, but in one, it is, his last words are, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Why? The diction's changed, hasn't it? Hell is over. Hell is done. Jesus, by the time he died, was finished with hell. People say then, well, what was Jesus doing for 3 days or 36 hours? Parts of 3 days. That's the way they calculated days. You know, Martin Luther said that he spent 3 days thumbing his nose at the devil. And, you know, Luther liked to talk that way. But there's a lot of insight in that. He was not, here's the point, he was not paying for sin more. He was not bearing God's punishment more. That was done when he said, it's finished. And the proof is that he says, Father, into your hands I commit your spirit. And one more time, it shows that Jesus' life was not taken away from him, but rather, he gave it up. No one took it from him. He voluntarily offered it. Let me just pause right there for a question or comment. I know we've covered a number of points. Not everything about the words of Jesus on the cross. I will say one more, just about one. Question or comment? Yes. How do you explain the deity and humanity of Christ and the separation from the Father? And you see, that's exactly the question that I was trying to avoid when I say that people, because when you start to probe that, things can go wrong. One person, let me just tell you what one person said as an example of what can go wrong. What can go wrong is, one man said, that the cry, my God, why have you forsaken me, is true of Jesus insofar as his humanity goes. But in his deity, he was as untroubled as the moon over a glassy sea. Well, one of the early Christian heresies is that of dividing the two natures of Christ and making him into two persons. Now, you can't have one Christ simultaneously giving a gut-wrenching cry, my God, why have you forsaken me, and another person of Christ, another nature of Christ, absolutely untroubled and calm. And there's a unity. You know, Jesus is one person. I think the best I can do, and maybe others can do better, I'm sure others can do better, is to say that at times Jesus' humanity is to the forefront, and at times his deity is to the forefront. They're always both there. But when Jesus dies, certainly his humanity is to the forefront, because God can't die. He didn't die in one sense, but Jesus bodily did die. And that's a very human thing and a human consequence of enduring what he had to endure. So I would say that the humanity of Jesus is to the forefront, and I would rather... See, this is a New Testament class. You have to ask questions like that in classes like God and Man. It's their job to answer that question in that class. It's my job to tell you what the text says, and it's their job to tell you what it means. Well, would you say that's my worst cop-out all semester? You're still smiling at me, though. I really don't. I don't see how we can fathom. There's some things that are just beyond us. And how Jesus can be one with the Father and yet say, my God, I think probably the best thing to do when you face many questions is simply to assert what you know. And then when you find yourself stepping into bad territory, you just say, I'm finite. And I can say sincerely, there are probably people who know better than I, but that's the best I can do. Some very interesting things happen after Jesus' death. There's an earthquake, and the veil of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom. Verses 51 through 53. The tearing of the curtain, again, from top to bottom, means, I believe, what we've always heard that it means. That is, the curtain separating the holy place, it doesn't say which curtain, holy place from the rest, or the holy of holies from the other holy place. But one way or another, the curtain that divided has been torn in half. So instead of one man entering the holy of holies once a year, that with a sacrifice, backwards, with a rope tied to him in case he died in there, they could pull him out. That's not mentioned in the Bible. I don't think it's in the tradition of the time. Anybody can go. Doors wide open. Free access to the presence of God. That's the point. And of course, from top to bottom, because it's not the act of a human, of a priest, ripping it from the bottom to the top, but by God, from top to bottom. An earthquake to show that this is an earth-shattering event. Other things happened. Other things happened. One of the things that happened is that people came out of tombs. Verse 53. Now, it does say, in case it's a little bit difficult, 52, tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs. And after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city. I read it this way, that it's not necessarily the instant that Jesus died that they came forward. Then they would have had to stay in their tombs, you know, for a little while or not move around, and then later moved into the city. I take it that he's reporting here that along with Jesus' resurrection, a number of others were raised, to suggest that Jesus' death, symbolically, I mean, I think it really happened, but it symbolizes that Jesus' death is our life. It is the life of the saints. And just to pick up something that I should have said a few minutes ago, there's also the word to the thief on the cross, too, you know. And that is, today you will be with me in paradise. You know, we need to just ponder that too. They both the tombs opening and the thief on the cross both indicate that Jesus' death really does accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish. When he says, today you'll be with me in paradise, what he's saying is, I'm going to die, you're going to die, again, not to send into hell, except maybe, as Peter says, to make a proclamation, to disclose what happened, not to descend into hell, to languish there or suffer there. Today, you'll be with me in paradise. Paradise door is opened, even for a man who, as I take it, earlier in the day cursed Jesus. Earlier in the day, both of them cursed. Later, he stands up for Jesus. And he, too, is forgiven for what he's done, because of his expression of faith and sympathy for Jesus on the cross. So the door of heaven is open. The door to God is opened. Resurrection is opened. Heaven is opened through the death of Christ. It goes on in Matthew to describe the burial of Jesus, placing of guards at a tomb. We could survey those things. What I'd rather do is maybe step back just a little bit and ponder what it would be like to be there after the death of Jesus. I would suppose that there are four viewpoints possible. Maybe nobody was quite getting everything, but this is what people would have seen. Maybe if they came upon the events in Jerusalem, stunned, wondering what to make of it all, including the signs, as well as Jesus' early death, as well as let's just say all the events. The mockers and the blasphemers first, including some Jewish leaders, including the populace. They've slain their foe. They won. There's his corpse. Perhaps they view it with grim satisfaction. We know we're right. He was wrong. We won. We got him. The soldiers, perhaps slowly gathering the tools of their trade, as unfeeling as spiders in an art gallery, not appreciating what's there. An unpleasant day's work, but the day's over. Perhaps pleased that they got the garments of Christ, one of whoever of them got that garment. Perhaps happy. The average person in the ancient world was, as I think we said before, probably the proud owner of 5 or 10, 7 to 10, maybe 12 garments, counting shoes. As strange as it may seem, to gain the clothes of someone who had been executed was probably a perk of the job. I don't say that lightly. One of them was happy. The others are probably sad that they didn't get it. And that's about all was in their mind. There are mockers today. There are soldiers today who see it and it means nothing to them. It's a story about something that happened a long time ago to somebody from a far distant country with whom I have to do nothing. There was one soldier who was different. One soldier said, surely this was the Son of God. Chapter 27, verse 54. Isn't it interesting that precisely in his execution, precisely indeed as he dies, at the time of his death, one who saw all that had happened realizes at last, one of them realizes, this is different. There are the faithful. This man coming to realization, the thief on the cross, still alive, I presume, the faithful women at the foot of the cross, surely weeping. The courage of Joseph of Arimathea to go and ask for the body of Christ to identify with this slain man by taking charge of his body to give him a decent burial, which would not be a given. Which would not be a given in that day. But it had to happen for God's purposes. At great risk, with no rewards beckoning, nothing, nothing. They could no reward, no praise, no gain. And yet they showed their loyalty to Christ, even to the last. The question, of course, is, where do we stand today? And I think here in this room we know the answer. There are still mockers who hate God, vast numbers who are indifferent, and then it still falls to his faithful to be faithful at all times, to stand in awe of him, even to stand, as we understand it so much better, in awe of his death, to take the risks, even when there's no reward, to show faithfulness in turn to him who is faithful to us to the end.